Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It is a podcast that's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, the news director at KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian, the head buyer at the bookstore, as always, is my co-host. And in the studio at the book club today, we have David Phillips, author of Wild Horse Country. In the book club edition of this, we talked about BLM's management and the roundups. And then one of the chapters that really jumped out at me, as well as at you, Arsene, was the one about the horse meat and the propensity in the 1920s to round up the horses and to make them into food. Now, for the US market, it was dog food, but it was getting shipped to Europe to be eaten by humans. And that's still an issue, where horse meat is still seen as very unpalatable for human consumption in the US. But in Europe, it's a delicacy.
Right. So, so what they were doing is essentially pickling it and sending it over there, like, you know, essentially corned beef, except it was corned horse. And I think actually up until the maybe the 40s, they were selling horse meat in the United States as well. But somehow along the way, it did become unpalatable here. And I think one of the reasons is that it was seen as a sort of switcheroo low-grade meat that would be sold as beef, even though it wasn't. And so it was all of a sudden became a sign of getting gypped. I will say, though, that you don't have to go very far over the border into Canada to see horse meat in the stores and in restaurants. I was in Montreal last summer, and you could get a horse steak at a number of the places where we were.
I always wondered whether we think it's unpalatable here in the US, and certain European countries also think it's unpalatable, because of our relationship to horses and because of this idea that horses are, you know, well, I suppose dogs are man's best friend, but horses are probably a close second.
Yeah, right. There are only two animals that we really consider our working companion animals, dogs and horses. And certainly, if you have a relationship with an animal, you, we name them, right? You don't want to eat something that you name. And in fact, if you think about the other meats that we do eat, we have a different name for the meat and the animal. You know, we don't say that we eat pig. We don't say that we eat cow. Interesting that we don't have a name for horse flesh.
I've eaten horse.
What did you think?
It was very gamey.
Yeah.
But interestingly,
it might have been the horse.
Maybe it was a horse. I don't think it was a wild horse. It was in France, where it's very popular. But I do remember a couple of years ago in Ireland, because Irish people don't like to eat horses either. But there was a scandal. I think it was in IKEA meatballs.
Yeah.
That they were saying that they were beef meatballs, but then it turned out that they were horse meatballs, and everybody was horrified. But then all these nutritionists came out and said, horse meat's actually better for you.
Quite lean.
And exactly, it's much leaner. And everyone started having this debate about why we don't eat horses.
Well, that doesn't get around the personality part of it.
Anything with eyelashes, I've been told.
Well, I think also in America, they're part of the national identity. They're part of the legend. You talk in the book about the legend of the white stallion.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem like it travels to all the other cultures. This is an American kind of legend where that white stallion in the distance can't be caught, and then it evolves to can't be tamed. And then eventually it becomes Moby Dick, the white whale.
Right.
You know, it transmutes. And this is a very powerful legend going long way back in our history.
I think more than any animal, it's a stand-in for our idea of America itself, even more than the bald eagle. Bald eagle is a symbol of federal power, but it's not really a symbol of American democracy, you know, of us. Whereas the horse, you know, it started out as this sort of this regal and uncatchable beauty. This was the legend of the white stallion. And that was the untamable wild frontier, right? And then it became sort of this idea of the lowborn nobility, you know, us. We're all working class people, most of us. We come from humble roots, and yet we need nobility and ideals in order to make our democracy work. And so the horse is a stand-in for that.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of your other reporting you've done. This is the books about horses. You had a book called Lethal Warriors. You've done a lot of reporting on veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And recently I heard you on the New York Times podcast talking about the guy who shot up the church down in Texas. And are you still, is that your main beat still, or are you diversifying more? Because it seems like you get called on when something happens involving veterans.
So at the New York Times, my fancy job title is national correspondent, and I write about veterans and the military. And I chose to live in Colorado Springs because per capita, that is the community with the most military and veterans. So I didn't want to be sitting in Manhattan trying to figure things out. I wanted to be there. Now, that means that also when shit goes down in the West, they call me. When somebody shoots up a concert in Las Vegas, I'm on a plane in an hour. When it turns out that a shooter from Texas had been living in Colorado Springs, I'm going to the trailer park where he used to live and knocking on doors. And that's actually one of the greatest parts about working for the New York Times is we have this common mission that we want to achieve. And if they need you, you know, if they need me, I'm happy to go. I'm happy to serve that mission.
Mm-hmm. So the Veterans Affairs, VA has been in the news an awful lot.
Yeah.
You know, what's your take on what's going on there? It seems like every 5 to 10 years, we're going to revamp the VA. Something's going to change. And years later go by and, people aren't getting the services they need. They're not getting the benefits that they deserve.
So you're going to hear all sorts of things about how terrible the VA is and how wonderful the VA is. And it's really hard to sort it out. And it's even harder when you realize that everything good and bad is true. It is, when I say a vast bureaucracy, it is the largest bureaucracy besides the military in the American government. And it employs hundreds of thousands of people, and it has millions of patients, and it has lots of things about it that need to be fixed and lots of things about it that are wonderful, you know. And in the same way that when you open the Daily Camera, they don't talk about all the cars that don't crash that day. They talk about the one that did and killed the preschool crossing the street. In that same way, I think that a lot of the news that you hear about the VA is quite bad. And I've written a lot of that news. So I'm not making excuses for the VA. But there's also an enormous amount of good that happens every day unnoticed.
Do you think... you've also written about the violence, the incidents of violence that returning soldiers are engaged in, maybe more so than the general population. Have you thought about this? I'm sure you've thought about it quite a bit, but do you have any ideas or ways that it can be better? Or, you know, where's that issue stand right now, you think?
That's what actually got me onto the military beat in the first place. I was noticing that people I knew who were coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan were getting in trouble. And when they were, oftentimes the military was not there to help or support them in any way. And in fact, they were kicked out of the military in ways that prevented them from getting help from either the military or the VA. And it just seemed so unfair and also dangerous, you know, to cut loose somebody who needs help. What's going to happen to them and us years down the line? That is a problem that's really hard, that I think the military's gotten a little bit better at identifying and treating. But it is so difficult because a lot of times the values that the military instills in young troops are the same ones that will prevent them from trying to get help for war trauma. You know, you are taught when you join the military that you are tougher than you think, that you can accomplish things that you couldn't have even imagined, and that complaining or trying to make excuses is not accepted, you know? And those are good values, right? And at the same time, they are barriers to care when you really need it. And I don't think that dynamic has been figured out yet.
In terms of other military issues, and I'm thinking I would say the Me Too movement now, of course, for the last few years, there's been endless reports about sexual assault in various different parts of the military, and particularly the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Now, of course, we have the Me Too movement bringing light to this issue across other industries. Do you think there's a lot more to be said about what's happening in the military?
So I think we think of the military as something other than us, and it's a lot like the rest of us. The military is a lot like a huge university. Almost everybody there is 18 to 22 years old, A couple folks stay on longer, and very few of them stay on for a whole career. A lot of the issues around campus sexual assault are the same ones that are in the military. Although, interestingly, the big difference is the gender ratio. So probably most people don't know this, but it was only last year that female sexual assaults outnumbered male sexual assaults in the military. It's always overwhelmingly been males that have been assaulted by other males. Are they getting better? I think in a lot of ways they are better than most universities because they don't try and sweep things under the rugs or treat things through some like pseudo-judicial system. They have a legal system there that treats it like any other crime. Is it perfect? No. And is there a culture that, like universities, encourages abusive drinking that can lead to sexual assault? Yeah. So they have a lot more to figure out. But I don't think that it is fair to single them out versus CU or any other big university in terms of the issues they deal with.
A previous interview that we've done on the book club was with a long-haul driver who was a mover, and he's moved a lot of military folk. And he said that you often know you're coming into a town that's got a military base because you got the secondhand car shops, lots, and the pawn stores. And it really shows you the economic reality for so many people who are in the military. I mean, is that the case in Colorado Springs?
There's certainly a lot of used car places down by Fort Carson. A lot of these are young folks. They are coming from pretty modest means. They didn't go to college. They're often leaving home because the military is the best opportunity for them. Certainly there's a grittiness that comes along with that outside of every military community. Nobody's ever going to vacation in Killeen, Texas, you know? There's also like an amazing upward mobility that the military promises that is really hard to find, actually, now that manufacturing has disappeared for people who don't have higher education. So, it is both gritty and poor at the start and can also promise enormous benefits that a lot of Americans don't have access to otherwise.
Well, that's the attraction. I mean, right? They advertise you can go to college afterwards. You're going to gain skills, and a lot of people in this country don't have another avenue to gain those skills.
Right.
And that's a tough thing.
Right.
Is there a story out there, or is there something you're working on regarding the military or even the West in general that's out there for you? Your kind of white whale that you'd like to work on or like to delve into in more depth.
Yeah. The story I'd love to spend some time on in the next year maybe is the families that are caught up in the Forever War. So there are people who are kind of elite soldiers, special forces or Delta Force, that their war never ends, right? Like even if we pull out of Afghanistan, then they're going to go to Mogadishu or Niger or Turkmenistan or somewhere. And they're gone half the year and they're back half the year. And they've been doing this for, I don't know, 15 years. And, you know, imagine you're pushing 40 and you've got three kids and that's your life. And imagine being those kids. And I don't think that story has really been done. Like, what do you do when war becomes the norm? And how do your norms change to fit that?
It's quite a departure then to write about wild horses having, you know, really focused on the military, or is it?
It is a departure. But I love it. I love the West. It's my home and it's my heart. You can sometimes zig and sometimes zag.
Well, David Phillips is the author of Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth and Future of the Mustang. He's been our guest at After Hours at the Radio Book Club. Thanks so much.
Thank you.